Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, why so many people seem to be in denial about coronavirus. Well over 3 million Americans have been diagnosed with COVID-19, and public health officials are alarmed by rising case rates in Texas, where several major cities are edging toward maximum occupancy in critical care hospital wards. This hour, we'll talk with Wake Forest University Professor Adrian Barden about why some people simply refuse to believe there's a problem, and about how we can recognize our own cognitive biases, whatever they may be. Our conversation starts after a short break. Heaped on Anthony Fauci's plate in the fight against COVID-19, the one that seems to really frustrate him is that many people don't believe his warnings. That's true in Texas, where recently around 10,000 people a day are diagnosed with the disease. How is it possible for anybody not to believe the pandemic is a problem? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Denial of the facts can be harmful to individuals and to the societies that surround them. But if you've ever tried to correct a Facebook friend's science denial by throwing more facts at them, you know how rarely that works. So why are we like this? Why do we sometimes refuse to believe what experts insist is true? And what are the consequences for our society? Adrian Barden is here to talk about this. He is professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University and author of the book, The Truth About Denial, Bias and Self-Deception in Science, Politics, and Religion. Adrian, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You've expressed surprise that Anthony Fauci is surprised by the widespread tendency to deny the findings of science when it comes to COVID-19. Is there something about science that makes it especially vulnerable to skepticism among people who are not experts?
Well, Dr. Fauci gave an interview not too long ago, and he talked about this sort of general anti-science bias that he found amazing. And that's how he accounted for this widespread refusal to follow public health guidelines on the virus. I think he was a little off the mark, actually. Most people actually express a lot of trust in science generally. If you ask people, like, you know, what figures do you trust, you list, you know, scientists, media, politicians, scientists, the generic scientist does actually very, very well in that kind of poll. Most people don't know much about science, and they rely on experts and expertise almost all the time. You know, how does electricity work? You know, how does my toaster work? How does chemistry work?
No idea.
We at best, most of us have a rather vague idea at best about these things, right? You know, should I take antibiotics right now, right? And if your doctor says take antibiotics, well, there's rarely a lot of pushback, you know, from the patient. The planet Neptune. Chris, have you ever seen the planet Neptune yourself?
I have not, but I believe it exists.
You believe it exists. That's right. Because, well, why not? The question is, why do we trust expertise most of the time, but then furiously deny it at certain other times? Well, things get different when your political or cultural identity is threatened by some kind of facts or evidence or scientific consensus. So there's science and there's politicized science. What's the atomic weight of helium? Nobody cares. Mm. Is the climate warming due to human action? Oh, well, now we have a problem, right? So that takes us to masks and social distancing and shutdowns. Well, most people don't think much about politics either. They don't think much about science in their day-to-day lives. And they don't think much about politics or ideology. And they just follow the lead of people they trust, people who they perceive as representing groups they identify with and who presumably have their interests in mind. And these could be politicians, in many cases, media, especially partisan media, church leaders, their peers, their peer group, their community. If we already identify with Trump and Trumpism and our governor who supports Trump. And therefore, we trust the signals and messages that Trump sends about what's important and what's important to our side and what is coming from their side, right? And then we just trust that. And we don't go off and then do our own dispassionate scientific research into public health issues like mask wearing. I mean, who has time for that? So we heard early on, very early on, that the virus was a, quote, you know, Democratic hoax. And now we're off to the races. We have the issue has been politicized. It's become a my side, your side thing. Now we know what our side thinks. What policies are threatening to our side? So one side just fell into line with that. And he had, you know, there was a lot of cooperation from state governments, the federal level, congressional, national congressional level, at the state level. And then we wind up with some extraordinary polarization on factual issues, like not just like we there's a lot of polling out there. Right. So they ask people, well, how concerned are you about the virus, or what do you think is more important, you know, shutting down the economy or, you know, keeping it going? So those are matters of opinion. But we also ask people in large polling and surveys, does wearing a mask slow the spread of the disease? And we see a massive partisan difference between self-identified Democrats and self-identified Republicans on the factual question as to whether or not that's the case. Is the death count from COVID overstated? We see 20-30 point difference between Republicans and Democrats on the factual question as to whether or not there's a large overstatement of the death count. What is the actual death count? So, it's politicized science. Politicized science is responded to in a fundamentally cognitively and emotionally different way than most other science, you know, the everyday science.
Just to make sure we're, you know, sort of hitting both sides on this, there are a lot of areas in which progressives reject science, scientific information about safe nuclear waste storage, gun laws, genetically modified foods. Is it the same as with the findings with conservatives, which is that the best educated people are the most adamant in their denials?
It doesn't have to do with education.
Okay.
Liberals and progressives are not these like superior human beings who, you know, have fundamentally different, you know, human psychology. I mean, most liberals also don't know much about either science, and they don't think much about politics. There's no fundamental advantage that progressive or liberals or leftists have on scientific knowledge, on scientific literacy, on political sophistication. They just happen to already be generally aligned with an idea, I guess you'd have to call it kind of socialist or communitarian ideology, where, you know, the state is there to work in favor of the public good. So, and that puts them generally aligned with public health scientists over other kinds of messengers, like, you know, pro-business politicians and business leaders. We have highly progressive enclaves in certain parts of the country where they don't, there's a widespread vaccine refusal for their children based on really bad science. Portland, Oregon, a real bastion of some serious lefty liberal progressivism, you know, continually votes down the idea of putting fluoride into the municipal drinking water supply, and they rely on very bad science. I mean, the interest groups that push that rely on very bad science. Liberals go to Whole Foods and they buy homeopathic medicine, which is just absolute shocking nonsense. And one more example, National Academy of Sciences in 2016 released a big report where they looked at about 70 different studies on the effects of genetically modified crops on agriculture, on the environment, and on personal health. And they reported that they, when looking at all those studies, they couldn't find any consistent negative effects from genetically modified foods. And progressives went crazy and they said, no, this is biased. No, they're in the pocket of Monsanto. They're in the pocket of big agriculture. There's something wrong with this report. Yeah, so absolutely. This is not about like two different kinds of human beings here. It's just that there's some issues that hit conservatives where they live ideologically, and some issues that hit progressives where they live ideologically.
All right, let's step back for a minute and talk about why we have this tendency to treat different kinds of information with either like quick acceptance or deep skepticism. First of all, how do we decide who is worthy of our trust?
I would like to give an adaptive answer to that, if I could go back a few hundred thousand or million years for a moment. So human beings, we know, Homo sapiens evolved in small groups, little tribes. And that's the last couple hundred thousand years. And that probably goes back even further, you know, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, down back millions of years. And our advantage was always social cooperation. That's our evolutionary niche. That's what gives us our advantage. We're not very strong or, you know, very tough. We don't do well on our own, but we're really good at getting together, making plans, cooperating, and accomplishing things. But what that means is that adaptively for any individual, you're not going to work well within a group if you don't share certain basic ideological worldviews. If you don't kind of, in large respects, you sort of view the world the same way. The ability to integrate into your tribe's worldview was, in many cases, more important than having true beliefs. You need to have true beliefs about like what plants are safe to eat, but you didn't need to have true beliefs about what gods you need to worship. You just needed to, like, if your tribe worships, you know, God XYZ, you'd better worship God XYZ, or else, you know, you're in trouble. You're not going to be able to integrate into the group. You're not going to be able to cooperate with the group. You're going to be on your own, and you're not going to survive. So the consequence of this is that we have this deep, deep, deep evolved talent for rationalization. That is to say, conforming. We have this adaptive trait where we conform not just our behavior, but our beliefs themselves to that of the groups that we identify with.
So we now exist in a world where it's not simply a matter of those in our village versus those who are in the outside world, right? How has our access to media complicated the way we perceive in and out groups? We might have 20 in groups and 40 out groups if we look in enough different contexts.
Right. Yeah, you're using the right terms there, in group and out group. That's the psychology term for whatever group we're identifying with right now, or whatever set of groups we identify with that we consider ourselves part of. That's in psychology, they call that the in-group, and other groups are called out-groups. This can be a fluid matter, and it can depend on the context, right? If you have a community that you live in, right? You have a geographical area that you live in. You have a set of affiliations and associations that you consider to be part of your identity at any given time. Now, and this can again, this can change according to context, right? If I ask you, look, tell me about yourself, and I say, you know, Chris, who are you, Chris? Tell me about yourself, and you might say something like this. Oh, let me make some things up here, right? Someone would be likely to say, well, I was born and raised in Texas, but my ancestors immigrated from Scotland. I'm a Methodist, but I'm a kind of a liberal on most social issues, and I'm an environmentalist. So, and now you've told me about yourself, right? And so, but what are all those things? Those things are all affiliations or associations with certain kinds of groups, right? And that's who you are. So now if someone brings up some factual information or information about a scientific consensus that undermines some of your group's belief systems, that feels like a personal attack.
All right, I'm going to jump in so we can talk more about that after the break. My guest is Adrian Barden, professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University and author of The Truth About Denial, Bias and Self-Deception in Science, Politics, and Religion. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Today we're trying to understand how denial affects our responses to COVID-19. So we're talking with Adrian Barton, who is professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University and author of a book called The Truth About Denial, Bias and Self-Deception in Science, Politics, and Religion. So, Adrian, before the break, you were saying that, you know, I have these things that, make up my identity or presumed identity. If you say something that contradicts what I have decided is a core belief or understanding of one of the groups I identify with, not only do I disagree with you, but I take that as a personal insult.
Yes. I mean, it's an attack on who, it feels like an attack on who you are. And we have a we're designed to defend ourselves, right? It's like the fight or flight response, right? When you're physically attacked, your body physically goes into overdrive to deal with that. And it turns out that our brains, when they're confronted with information that feels threatening to you, they go into a very similar mode. And now you start exercising what's called confirmation bias, which is where listen. You're going to listen to evidence and expertise that you find congenial to what you wanted to believe in the first place, to what you feel is what your side believes, what the side that you've identified with, and you'll disregard expertise coming from that tells you something that contradicts that worldview, automatically. Right. It happens before you even non-cognitive process. It happens before you even think about it. You already know, you already feel deep down that wearing a mask can't be as important as they say, because you know that your side doesn't believe in wearing masks. And so you don't hear and you just don't put much stress on information about there being a scientific consensus that one should wear a mask.
So it strikes me when I think about these things that, of course, I can always find examples of like other people denying true facts, things that are indisputable or established. But I realize that I'm probably doing this too. You note that reasoning is not a self-transparent process. What does that mean?
We're not these free-floating reasoning machines. We like to think of ourselves as these perfectly rational beings when it comes to our beliefs, right? Where information goes in one end, it gets processed, and then beliefs come out the other end, right? But that's really not how it works at all. We have all kinds of unconscious, implicit biases that we engage in really all the time in the face of information that we find threatening for the reasons that we've been talking about.
So a couple years ago, I had to buy a car for the first time in like 12 or 15 years. And, you know, I went out and gathered information and made my decision based on facts. It wasn't like I was concerned that my friends would think one way or another. I just looked at facts. It seems as if, you know, in our heads, we're making decisions about all of our beliefs in this same way. Why can't we tell that we're using different tools for reasoning about things when our identities are involved?
Because we're designed for self-deception. We're designed to avoid really carefully and dispassionately reasoning about certain things because of this groupishness that we have, right? Going back to our ancestors scrabbling around through the forest, if you're that person in the group who questions everything and who wants to work through everything rationally, you know, you're the one who comes up and says, "Wait a minute, I'm not so sure about this God XYZ that we're all worshiping, right? I'm not sure about the evidence for that." Boy, that's not going to work out well for you, right? You're better off, you know, adaptively, you're better off not carefully reasoning about certain kinds of beliefs or certain kinds of information. And so we unconsciously engage in a process, and it's normal. Being in denial is a normal process, and it's not necessarily irrational. I mean, if you're in if you're an oil refinery worker and you start telling your coworkers, well, geez, I'm really worried about climate change. I'm not really sure about what we're doing here. I mean, what's the result going to be for you, right? At the very least, you know, social ostracism or getting fired, right? If you're in a really liberal community and you start, you know, questioning whether or not questioning gay marriage or something like that, you're going to get the same kind of response. You're going to get canceled, right? Defriended, unfollowed, blocked. And this has only gotten worse. You mentioned the media earlier, right? This has only gotten worse in our current media environment, right? Where you have these social media bubbles. You just surround yourself with like-minded people. You have media echo chambers where you have a TV channel you can tune in, and you can get 24 hours a day. You can hear exactly what you want to hear, right? And nothing else. And human beings have also, Americans have also separated themselves pretty well geographically into like-minded communities, right? You can draw a line, you can take any rural area in the U.S. and draw a line from that to the center of the nearest big city. And that line's is gonna start out red, and then it's gonna get bluer as you get to the center of the city, right? Hmm. That'll work almost anywhere. So and then what you get there is you get something called group polarization, which is this process kind of feeds on itself. Because we know from a lot of social science studies that when you put a lot of really like-minded people together, they tend to sort of reinforce each other and get more and more extreme and more cognitively inflexible and less open to, you know, evidence that contradicts their worldview. So yeah, it's a self-reinforcing process.
All right, I want to talk about compartmentalization. Sometimes we are forced to cope with new information that is hard to deny, but seems to require us to change our existing beliefs. So, for example, the president had this rally in Tulsa a couple of weeks ago. Authorities uh-huh. there really recommended that everybody wear a mask. Lots of people were given masks as they walked in and kind of threw them away right away. There's been an uptick in cases that health officials in Tulsa think might yes. well be related to this rally. Yeah. If you went to that rally thinking that COVID-19 was a hoax or overplayed, and now you are lying at home or, God forbid, in a hospital very sick, what do you do with the fact that you believed this was a hoax before and now you've been forced to confront the fact that it exists?
Well, presumably everybody has some kind of tipping point. It's just kind of amazing when you observe actual human behavior and changes in attitude, you know, what it takes to change someone's attitude towards a politicized position of fact. It's amazing how much it takes. I mean, everyone's presumably has some kind of tipping point. Yeah, once you're in the hospital and you can't breathe, yeah, that's when you might start to rethink it. Once as the saying goes, you know, everyone's going to believe in climate change when they're knee deep in seawater. But the problem is that it's too late at that point. With the virus, we have what at this point qualifies as just a runaway exponential increase in a number of southern and western states, as you know. You're still not seeing the kind of, you know, extreme, you know, public response in most cases that the public health officials would like to see. You figure there's got to be a point eventually. I mean, you know, like when the hospitals are all filled up, as they have been in some areas, right? The ICUs are filled up, and now everybody with COVID is filling up the ER. Now the ER is filling up. We still don't seem to have gotten to that point, and it's just an extraordinary fact about human nature how much it takes for you to finally, you know, flip on an issue that you really got ideologically committed to because of what your leadership has told you is what your side believes.
All right, I want to go to the phone. Charles is calling from Plano, Texas. Hi, Charles.
Thank you, and thank you for an interesting topic. I am a truck driver, and to your point about why people are in denial, let me give you my viewpoint from what, as a trucker, TV, radio, you know, interacting with truckers all over. What he alluded to earlier when he said that the president, once he initially said it was a hoax, and it became political then, it was political side. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. And there's one, in addition to that, one other element. For example, a lot of my coworkers, truckers, they believe everything that the president says, and it's gospel. In addition to that, compounded with that mindset, they listen to right-wing talk radio religiously, daily, and they hear it. It's reiterated over and over again. It's a hoax. It's just the Dems are making it up. It's not as serious as people say it is. So I would agree, and I think that's why people are in denial, because, like he says, they listen to what the leader, and then now it's reiterated on a daily basis by the stuff they listen to, which happens to be right-wing talk radio.
Well, Charles, I'm so glad you called. Do you want to respond to that, Adrian?
I really appreciate Charles's call, and I think he made a really good point and a really good comparison there. He talked about how his friends take what Trump says as gospel, and they have a religious belief about what Trump says. And, well, that's not a terrible analogy at all. Science denial is, in these politicized contexts, is notoriously resistant to facts, because it was never about facts in the first place. Well, generally, we don't form ideological affiliations because of reasoning. People generally don't get either talked into or out of their ideological worldview. It's something they already have this affiliation, and then when somebody tells them something is true, they believe it automatically. They don't go through this process of reasoning where they examine the evidence. And think about religion for a second. I mean, the vast majority of people are religious, but it's not like we're all completely agnostic and neutral on the question until we're 21 years old. And then we sit down with a stack of religious texts and scientific papers, and then we go through it, and we do a lot of research, and then we go, aha, Shintoism is the one true religion, right? Or, aha, there is no God. That's not how it works at all. No, the vast majority of people, by the time they're age 5, they're already affiliated with that worldview. And that's going back to long before anybody gave them reasons to believe it. They didn't work through the philosophical and scientific questions about why they would believe in this particular god or gods. So why would you think, if that's the case, why would you think that you could reason somebody out of something that they weren't reasoned into in the first place? If it's not based on reasons, why would it be amenable to reasons?
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship, Adrian, between our factual beliefs and our moral values? So often we say this is morally true or untrue because this other thing is a fact.
Well, personally, I think, and I would have some philosophers and social scientists, some on my side with this, I think morality starts with a feeling like empathy, which is a natural to us. And when a young child or infant sees, someone being harmed or being bullied, it makes them feel bad. And I think that sort of thing, plus values and attitudes that are learned early on, are really the basis for what we call our moral judgments. So I don't think our moral judgments are based on facts. I think our idea that there are moral facts is based on feelings. Feelings that are we all tend to sort of like agree on what the moral facts are for the most part, because we're all human beings and we have a similar psychology and we have similar feelings. But personally, I think when we say like there's a moral rule out there, don't murder somebody, I think what's really happening there is actually something non-cognitive. That is to say, what you're really saying is that I dislike murder, or my society dislikes murder, or I believe that my God dislikes murder. And that's a very different kind of statement from saying murder is wrong, or there's some objective moral rule about that. It's kind of like, rooting for a team. If you're out there, like if you're a Dallas Cowboys fan, right? And you say the Dallas Cowboys are the best team in the world. that's not really what you, what you're really saying there is something very different. That's not a factual statement at all. You're really saying go Cowboys, right? You're just cheerleading. And I think that's the case in the case of moral judgments. And fortunately, most human beings, you know, share a lot of those same basic drives and impulses. And so we wind up making a lot of the same moral judgments. But our thought that, that there's some moral facts out there is a kind of psychological projection.
Why am I more likely to broadly distrust you if you tell me the Jets are the greatest football team ever?
Because... because we are wired up so well to take sides, and it's just a deep fundamental part of our cognitive makeup. It was the number one thing we had to do to survive during our evolutionary history was to integrate into our perceived group's ideological worldview. So we are so groupish by nature. And then you get these weird, you know, offshoots of that, which is like, you know, this maniacal, you know, devotion to a sports team, for example, right? Or just having Trump, you know, say one thing, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, forget public health recommendations. That's all wrong somehow, right? Or overstated, or it's a hoax, and it's so automatic, and then that. Automaticity, that automatic, you know, feeling that of my sideness, then affects your judgments as to what you like objectively see out there in the world.
My guest is Adrian Barden, professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University and author of The Truth About Denial, Bias and Self-Deception in Science, Politics, and Religion. Chris Boyd. Today we're talking about how denial affects responses to COVID-19 with Adrian Barden, professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University and author of The Truth About Denial, Bias and Self-Deception in Science, Politics, and Religion. So we're focusing here, Adrian, on the science portion of what you're thinking about. With religion, you know, people who have religious faith believe that there are some universal and sort of timeless truths. The thing about science is that conclusions are often shifting. As more information comes in, scientists often will amend their conclusions. Does that make scientific reasoning more susceptible among regular non-scientist individuals to skepticism? Because last year they said, or 10 years ago they said, don't eat fat if you want to avoid heart disease. And now the information has shifted.
And nutrition scientists is one of them that's been all over the place. You get their response a lot when you say, look, global warming is real. And people say, well, no. You know, science is not a body of facts or dogmas. And that is absolutely true. It's not a dogma or a doctrine. It's a process. It's a process of, you know, hypotheses, modeling, blind testing, peer review, replication. And nothing is allowed to be called an unchangeable doctrine. And that's great about the scientific process. But some theories are overwhelmingly well supported by the process at this time. I mean, you have a flat Earth society out there, right? The evidence that the Earth is spherical rather than flat is just simply overwhelming right now. And in the absence of some really radically new information, they just have no business asserting that the Earth is flat. We have the germ theory of disease. You know, people used to think that diseases were caused by demons or something like that. I think we have really, really loads of evidence over a long period of time that diseases are caused by, you know, viruses, bacteria, parasites. And in the absence of something really radically new, you just have no business saying, well, I'm just not going to pay attention to, you know, public health advocates because, you know, science is not a dogma. Well, that's true. Germ theory is not a dogma. It's not a doctrine that's handed down from above, right? Human-caused global warming. Is overwhelmingly well supported by the science. The benefits of vaccinating your children, the fact that vaccines don't cause autism is overwhelmingly well supported. Yeah, but in the absence of truly radical new counter evidence, it is unreasonable right now to reject an overwhelming scientific consensus.
We have an email here from Liz who wants to know, how much is an inability or unwillingness to back down a factor in disbelieving evolving evidence?
One thing I'd really like to stress is that we know, and there's, once again, there's tons of social science research on this point, is that science denial is not about being either stupid or uneducated. So what we do have is many studies showing that your stance on a politicized science issue has much more to do with your political or cultural background than with what you know, right? In fact, on various politicized science issues, a whole list of them that have been studied in the lab, we see higher levels of polarization and cognitive inflexibility, the unwillingness to accept new evidence, in people who have higher levels of education, who score higher on measures of political sophistication, on cognitive ability, on quantitative reasoning skills. Let me go back to climate one more time. On conservatives and climate science denial, we know that if you're a political conservative and therefore you're already affiliated with a group that doesn't want to believe in climate change, you're more likely to be a climate science denier if you have a college education versus not college education. You're more likely to be a climate science denier if you score high on climate science literacy tests. Now, what is this telling us? Well, this is telling us that what's going on here is rationalization rather than reasoning. And what happens in rationalization is that the more information you have, it's not being deployed in the way that dispassionate reasoning is being deployed. The more information you have, it's just the more ammunition you have to convince yourself that what you already believed in is right. You've just got more to work with now, right? Some people blame climate change and global warming on something called Milankovitch cycles, which are these hundreds of years, thousands of years, changes in the tilt of the earth, right? And that's what the bloggers are saying. Oh, no, it's not human activity. It's Milankovitch cycles. Well, you have to, in order to, write that blog, you have to know about Milankovitch cycles, right?
So scientists themselves are not like a special species of human beings.
No.
I would imagine they're no less susceptible to these kinds of cognitive errors than the rest of us. What mechanisms exist within science to try and expose and avoid these biases?
Some people would describe the entire process of science, like what it is, as an attempt to counteract these biases. You've got scientists criticize each other constantly. It's an inherent part of the modern scientific process. Whenever you submit a paper or an essay, an article, a study for review, and it's sent out to your peers, and your peers just go after it. They look at your methods and they look at your data and they look at your data analysis and they look at your conclusions and they look for something to criticize. And then, if you get published, then other people, they can try to, replicate your findings. Indeed, that's an inherent part of the process. One finding is never considered, something that establishes the truth of something. You have to have, repeated findings by different people, and you have blind testing. Like if you're testing a new drug or something, it's a very important process that you do blind testing. You're right. Scientists are not at all different in terms of fundamental human psychology. They're not some kind of superior type of species. It is the case, though, that if you're a professional, science researcher, you are part of like a pretty small self-selected group, right? First of all, you were privileged enough to go to a good college or university, and then what do you decide to do with yourself? You decide to spend the next, if you want to get like a PhD or equivalent, the next 10 years, getting your, doing graduate coursework, doctoral degree, postdocs, all of it not getting paid very much, right? All these years, well, you must be primarily interested in learning and finding the truth about things. Otherwise, why in the world would you do that? I mean, it's a crazy decision if you have some other motivations going on there. So I think there's something to be said about, you know, when you know, the when somebody says that, you know, COVID-19 has this kind of, you know, infection rate according to the data, that they're generally not trying to make a political point or something like that. It's like I've been working my butt off for decades to be able to draw this kind of conclusion.
All right, let's go back to the phone. Dan is calling us from Granbury, Texas. Hi, Dan.
Hi, good afternoon. Great show.
Thanks.
My question has to do with some things that already been touched on. I'm an old guy. I'm retired from the university business. I was a university geek most of my career. And yet I came from a very conservative family background, religious and all that. But over the years, I've evolved considerably. I'm probably what you would call a liberal now. My question is there any work that shows a predisposition in the people who, and I don't really like labels, but who identify toward the liberal end of the spectrum, are more open to changing their beliefs than the ones who are on the other end of the spectrum?
Thanks for calling, Dan. What do you know about that, Adrian?
Aha. Well, this is a rather controversial topic. And there are dueling books and articles on this point. When you give, there's a widely respected personality test out there. It's called the Ocean Test, about five different personality traits. And one of those traits, the O stands for openness, openness to experience. And a high score on openness to experience on this personality test is pretty predictive of whether or not you're a liberal or progressive in terms of your politics. And so some people take that to be indicative that, well, you know, that liberals are at the very least going to therefore, you know, like ally themselves with scientific experts a little more. Because, you know, I mean, science is all about kind of overturning the status quo, about, you know, finding new things, you know, new results, you know, things that change how we think about the world. And if you, by personality, are more open to diversity and more open to other kinds of experiences, which is what, personality tests do find about liberals. People have proposed that that's going to make liberals more able to deal with, you know, to handle information new information that doesn't necessarily coincide with their existing worldview. You know, in the 1960s, just to digress for a second, the left was considered more the anti-science group in the 60s. You know, the left was anti-pesticides, anti-nuclear power, pollution, industrial production, and that started changing. Sometime around 1970, and conservative, and we see in the general social survey, which has been done since some back 1974, we see a gradual slight decline in conservatives' trust in science. And what happened over that period of time is that a new kind of science kind of arose, and some sociologists call it impact science. And that is to say, some of the most salient science today is not about how we produce things, but what is the impact of production, right? So if you're starting out as a conservative, you're like, have this kind of pro-business, small government attitude. But now you've got more and more science, and more of like what you hear about science has to do with the negative effects of production, the negative effects of industry, pollution and, you know, climate change and things like that. Well, this is starting to get more and more threatening to the status quo. And conservatives, by definition, are comfortable. This is what conservatism is. Conservatism is being comfortable with existing cultural traditions and the existing social and economic order, right? So when you have whole fields of science over the course of decades producing information that really call for big government solutions and big social and economic changes, you would kind of expect the political conservative to feel threatened by that kind of science.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right. So if just throwing facts at people does not tend to do the trick, what advice would you give scientists working today to reduce the spread of COVID-19? Like, what are the most effective ways of communicating important facts to people who enter the conversation inclined to disbelieve what scientists have to say?
Well, you're right. It doesn't seem like more information about, you know, telling them again and again, you should wear a mask, we should social distance, this thing is increasing exponentially. That doesn't seem to be working so far. I would focus here, and this sounds kind of cynical. I would appeal to self-interest and try to depoliticize the issue that way. I'd say, like, look, the hospitals in your town are full. The ERs are full. That's a problem for you, right? How are your kids going to go to school this fall, right? Well, you know, how the way to do that is we need a national strategy, and we need a lot of federal funding in each of those cases to get our hospitals, you know, your hospitals open, to get your schools open. You know that old, I think the environmentalists came up with this thing, the saying, think globally, act locally, right? Have mm-hmm. you heard that?
Yeah.
Well, I think to deal with this kind of situation, with this kind of denial, I think you have to think locally and act globally. Explain why the big top-down, big government solutions are going to, how they're going to affect your local, your well-being and the things that you're interested in locally. And I'm sorry if that sounds cynical and not very, you know, progressive and optimistic, but at this point, that I don't see what else is going to work.
Adrian Barden is professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University and author of the book, The Truth About Denial, Bias and Self-Deception in Science, Politics, and Religion. Adrian, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for KERA Think. If you want to listen on our website, you can go to think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.